This is Making Conversation, the Australian Composers Podcast. Here's Sasha Kelly interviewing composer Connor Donetto in Brisbane, Queensland.
I met with Connor Donetto in late 2016 in beautiful Brisbane weather. We set up at his very busy work desk right next to a grand piano and covered in sheets of paper. He was one of the youngest composers I'd interviewed, and at the time of recording, Connor had just completed his university degree. We talked about his upcoming commission for the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra Cybeck program and his ideas for future study. Alongside his composing, Connor is the producer and artistic director of contemporary music collective Argo, which he founded in 2015. Throughout this conversation, you'll hear clips of Connor Donetto's piece, Three Adoxographies. And an adoxography is fine writing on a trivial or base subject. This is my conversation with Connor Donetto. So I'm sitting here in Brisbane in the lovely Wishart with Connor Donetto. Connor, what can you tell me about yourself? I'll start with you. I'm going to put the onus on you. What can you tell me about where you are as a composer right now?
Right. Okay. So I'm currently finishing the last year of my undergrad degree in music and composition, studying with the wonderful Robert Davidson at the University of Queensland. And I guess at the moment I'm just doing a lot of freelance work. Commissions and that kind of stuff. I also run a concert series here in Brisbane that looks at presenting contemporary classical music combined with electronic music, which is called Argo. Currently planning the 2017 season at the moment, which is a fun task. At the moment I'm just working on a number of different commissions for ensembles around the place. One for the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra for their Cybeck program, and another one, the one I need to actually finish in the next week, for the Camerata of St. John's, the Queensland's Chamber Orchestra, for them to play on their regional Queensland tour. What else would you like to know?
Well, that sounds fabulous. I actually might jump into a conversation about your processes, because we're sitting right now at your, makeshift home studio, just an arm's length away from your piano. So what's a regular day like for you? Do you wake up? Do you compose for a certain amount of hours? How do you finish, how do you work through your projects?
Okay, so when I'm writing on a work, I find I work best writing in short bursts, in terms of like a solid week to work on a piece, or a solid couple of weeks. So when I have a day where I'm writing, I try blocking off an entire day. I'm a late sleeper, so I probably won't be up till 11 and wouldn't have had breakfast but till, lunch. But afterwards, I would sit down at the piano. I would work through at the piano till about 4 or 5 in the evening. Take a break, go for a run, have dinner, and then I'd come back, but then I would be sitting at either my desk or on the couch with my laptop to typeset up what I had written during the day. So during the day is at the piano, pencil and paper, and at night it's typesetting whatever I've written out.
So walk me through working at the piano. Do you just play whatever comes to mind, or do you work over particular fragments over and over? Can you really analyze how you come up with ideas and how you workshop them?
Okay. I guess before the actual getting to the piano and getting to that kind of stage is the planning and the conceiving of the work kind of stage. So that, could probably take a couple of days or a week or a month, depending on how long I've been brewing over that particular piece, which is in paper, and just kind of coming up with different textural ideas at first. Whatever the starting point of that particular work is, it's different each time. Looking at orchestration and the length of the piece, kind of making some sort of decisions on as to the structure of the piece and length, and I kind of essentially measure out the piece to a fairly good degree before getting to the piano. All of that's completely flexible, but it's a starting point. Then when at the piano, I've kind of already got a bit of a framework to work into, probably start off with me just improvising until I find something that I kind of like, and when I've kind of latched onto something, it'll be a fairly slow development from there, just working on the, you know, working on a section. I like to set myself fairly kind of measured deadlines or measured quotas for the day, I guess. You know, I have to write the next 50 bars or the next 2 minutes worth of the piece or something like that in the day, or I want to draft it or that kind of thing, or work out this chord progression. So I usually go into each day with a fairly set idea of what I'm looking at for the next, for that day, I guess.
Talk me through how you get inspiration for pieces, because I know that you're multi-talented. You're not just a composer. You obviously play the piano, but you've also got a background in... I'm not asking you to play the piano in public. Okay. but you also sing. So how do you get your inspiration, and do you think these multitude of influences actually helps you have that broader scope?
I definitely think that having a background in performance is incredibly valuable to me as a composer, and I think generally in composition you need to have a good grounding in, well, how it's going to be performed. So yeah, as you said, I play piano when I was young, and I haven't practiced in years except for my fiddling around at the piano to write, but it gets me by. But I currently perform as a classically trained bass in a number of ensembles around the place, and I also have a background in violin. So definitely being, especially violin, having a knowledge of string instruments. I've dabbled on the cello, but I was pretty terrible at that. Having a background in string instruments definitely makes writing easy. In terms of inspiration, I don't know, it's different from piece to piece, I think. I guess sometimes you're given a fairly tied in commission and you just work within the boundaries. For me, I'm not a programmatic composer. I'm not trying to write you a story. You're not going to find me giving you, that's a better way of putting it, I'm not going to be giving you a story that you're meant to be finding in the piece of music, but rather on my end, I would be taking very abstract influences from different things, from anything from nature or situations and emotions and all of that, to maybe find some sort of allegory for me, or find a way that that kind of translates into textures, different orchestrations. Whether or not you, when you listen to it, you find anything the same as me is kind of the beauty of it, I guess, that I can have been thinking of hot summer's day or a humid summer's day, and I would have used that to write a piece, to write a section, and then someone else listens to it, and they come up to me after the concert, and they tell me, I really loved that piece. It was like being out in the ocean. Great. There's no problem with that whatsoever. So for me, finding inspiration is a really good way for me to be coming up with new musical ideas.
So that's really interesting, because you've started talking about the audience and people's reaction to mm-hmm. your music.
Yeah.
Have you had much opportunity yet to interact with an audience with your music? You run your own concert series, so I presume that there's been some opportunities to out your music there.
Yeah.
And does that affect you as a composer when you get that kind of feedback?
I definitely think so. I think that we are in the business of art, but it's also you can't be completely closed off to what the audience is doing. I do care what the audience thinks. And, you know, if they go completely against what I want to be doing with my music, I'm not going to flip over and change my style. But there is an amount that you want to know what the audience is thinking. You want to know what they found was interesting. And yeah, that's very interesting. As you said, I have had, I do run a concert series, as I mentioned before. So that does give me a good opportunity in which when my works are performed, that I am able to interact with the audience. And the what I love about the kind of concert series that I'm doing is it's a fairly casual, relaxed attitude. It's none of this. There's no stage and audience. It's very democratic, and you get to meet people. And you know, I really enjoy after and before the concerts getting to mix with the audience and the performers and everyone talking together and reflecting on how the concert went and the music and just being social and all of that.
Is the kind of impetus to start the concert series, was that from your performance background? Was that to find more opportunities? What have you learned as that's kind of grown on? I know that's a big question, mm-hmm. but
yep.
Is that been at the forefront of your mind while you've been doing these concerts?
So the concert series, Argo, it started off around May last year, that just by myself and one of my best mates, who's also a performer and a composer and a producer, Ben Heim. We were just having a drink and wanted to essentially put on a concert of all of our own music and just organize one of them. And we started getting going on that. And we were looking at promotion and all of that. And we kind of realized that this was working pretty well. It was working well together. We could probably keep doing this and keep running it and make it a bit somewhere between a new music ensemble / collective and a concert series. So we came up with the name Argo with the intention of continuing to do it. So I guess the initial impetus was we just wanted to put on a concert, get to write a whole heap of new music, but it was also that we wanted to do a concert that was fairly different. We both work in this kind of post-genre-y, post-minimal field of music, and we both really enjoy how you can combine contemporary classical music and traditional classical music, acoustic instruments and all that, with contemporary influences and with contemporary technology, and also how we can present it in a different way to what you usually get, how we can write a work which can be performed in a concert, in a recital, in a concert hall or whatever, but then when we perform them, we do something completely different. So the first concert we programmed in the University of Queensland Art Gallery, which it's a beautiful art gallery designed by the same architect who designed QPAC, the Performing Arts Centre here in Brisbane. Beautiful art gallery, and at the time they had an exhibit on with called Light Play, with all works that either focused on light as the subject or the medium. So there were sculptures made out of neon lights and beautiful kind of stuff, and I think it worked really well with kind of our musical aesthetic aligned fairly well to the visual aesthetic, I guess, in some ways. So we programmed a concert. Well, we wrote an entirely original concert for that concert to be performed in that venue. But where we had musicians spread across the venue, we had, you know, in one room there was a piano and a cello playing Trace's piano and cello sonata, which I wrote. And in another room we had four singers singing a song. In another room we had a solo viola and electronics piece. And then we put together a surround sound speaker system around the entire venue so that wherever you were, you could hear this kind of ambient electronic texture atmosphere that we created, soundscapes. And other works which are amplified. And so the audience was, there was no chairs, and the audience was wandering around the whole venue the entire time. And that was, I guess, our first main foray into doing this kind of concert. And that's kind of, and we've kind of taken many of those ideas, the surround sound aspect, the having so the surround sound aspect in electronics, but also kind of seeing how we can present classical music and acoustic instruments in surround sound, I guess, and that kind of stuff. Which has been really interesting, and we've kind of continued that through the concert series, and hopefully next year there's going to be some amazing things going even further into that.
You've kind of touched a little bit on it in that last answer that you gave, but we've got a question from a project patron, Cameron Lamb, and he's asked what outside of music most inspires you or your work. So you've talked there about this immersive experience of the influence of light as a medium and as an inspiration. Is there other... other textural influences on your work?
So in terms of simply for that concert series is really great because for each concert we choose a different venue in a different space and a different iconic venue which has its really unique properties, and we write an entire concert of works specifically focused on highlighting that venue's most unique qualities. So I think working with spaces is because music isn't heard in a vacuum. You do hear it in a space, and how that acoustic interacts with your music vastly shapes the way you hear it. So, you know, from a concert halls are all designed with a specific acoustic in mind, and similarly recital venues. So we wanted to completely go out of that and find different places that had a completely different acoustic and how we could work with them. So one of my favorite concerts of the year is we wrote a concert for to be performed in St. John's Cathedral, the big Anglican cathedral here in Brisbane. And so for the concert, we had, rather than having everyone up at the altar and like a stage, we turned everything on its head. We had one piano down near the front door, another piano up near the altar. So they were playing a duet for two pianos, which Ben and I co-wrote. But the two pianos are separated by 50 meters with the audience in the middle. We had our electronics set up in a station in the middle. We had four flutes off in the corners of the building where you couldn't see them. We did it at night in the dark. So you'd have these kind of light flute improvised textures kind of flowing around in surround sound, but you couldn't even see where they were coming from. A string quartet down one end of the building with another violin soloist up the other end. A flute and viola duet, which was performed off in a balcony. And then visuals projected over the entire ceiling of the cathedral. So the audience was, the chairs were kind of moved around, and some audience lay across the floor of the cathedral and just stared at the ceiling. And the music was all written specifically with that acoustic in mind. The, you know, reverb's so incredibly vast. I think one of the ways Ben described it was sound crushing, because anything you played in there, it just went on and went on. Everything kind of melded together, so we wrote music that really benefited for that and was written specifically with that in mind.
Thank you.
So a question that has come to mind as you're talking is, if money and safety and all those kind of constraints was no object, where would be a space that you would just be dying to put on a concert?
I've always loved the idea of doing a concert. It's not so much money and safety, it's just logistics and... Mm. Well, instruments are delicate things. I've always wanted to do a concert outside. Imagine a forest and people just kind of leaning up against trees and then musicians around the place and then set up surround sound. You can't really hear instruments if you end up acoustic instruments when you're outside unless you amplify them a lot and, you know, water and humidity and all of that, especially in Brisbane.
Yeah.
It's not exactly, and especially since I kind of most of the time work in the world of string players, it's not exactly the most... feasible thing, but I'd love to do it if I could. But other venues, I don't know, it's anywhere really unique. Of course, I'd love to do the kind of classic warehouse concert, kind of, you know, shabby New York style warehouse, but there's not too many of them that haven't already been converted into a cafe by now. On the lookout for anything new and different. And
let's go back to when you first started composing. So can you remember the first piece of music you ever composed?
I can. My entrance into the world of music, besides, you know, having learned piano as a little kid and violin, was that I started singing as a chorister in the St. John's Cathedral Choir when I was about 10 years old. So that was 3 services a week, 5 rehearsals a week as a 10-year-old for every week of the year except for 3 weeks after Christmas. So which was pretty intense, and we, you know, sang lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of new music. And when I was about 13, I remember thinking, how hard could it be to write a mass setting? I don't know. I'm just going to try. So I ended up writing, as a 13-year-old, 2 movements of a mass setting, which were never performed, and they were probably pretty terrible, although my choir master at the time did kind of pat me on the back and say, yes, Connor, they're lovely, and you have a good understanding of structure. But that was the first thing I ever wrote. Fortunately, I don't have that piece anymore because my computer died and everything went with it. Well, that the computer I had at the time. Since then, I guess I know I kept doing little bits and pieces for high school music. You have to write some things. Teachers seemed to like what I was writing, so I guess I wrote more, did composition for music extension. Thought that I guess I'd like to keep doing it in university, and went from there.
Do you remember what it was like, that transition between high school and university? And was there quite a difference between, you know, having composition as something that you were doing? Obviously you had aspirations to become a composer, but moving into that world where everyone was moving towards a similar goal of being a professional musician?
What I really like about the course structure at the University of Queensland, it's a bit different, is that for your first 2 years of your degree, you have to be a performer. So I got in as a singer, and then you'd hand in a portfolio at the end of your second year and you would continue on to composition. So during that time, I was writing music, but I don't think I finished one piece of music during that time. I think I started things, realized they were terrible, abandoned them, started them again, kept going and going and going, and I didn't finish a thing. In terms of, you know, everyone going towards wanting to be a professional, that I strived on that. I preferred the kind of self-driven nature of university life compared to high school. And when I finally got around to doing composition, what that really gave me was it justified me dedicating significant hours to doing it. I guess, you know, I don't practice singing as much as I used to anymore. But essentially it was, you know, the 3 hours or 4 hours a day that my singing teacher was telling me I had to practice, I could now dedicate to composing. And that really got me to knuckle down and write a lot of music in a fairly short amount of time and really develop my compositional voice as well as my compositional technique in quite a fast period.
When you talked earlier and you said that, you know, a mass and experimenting with vocal settings was your first foray into composition, do you think that, and then of course you did 2 years of performance as a singer, has singing and the style used in choral music really influenced your body and your aesthetic as a composer?
I think it's definitely the few times that I write choral works, it definitely has. I definitely have a style of choral music that I really enjoyed, and that's kind of been brought to the couple of choral pieces that I've written. I haven't written much choral music. I guess my interest has always been in instrumental music in terms of composition and string music. And which
is there a reason for that? Like, is it just what's challenging you at the moment, or is it the opportunities?
Not really, I think. Part and part. I think that maybe it was the music that when I wasn't performing, it was the music that I maybe listened to in the classical music was string quartets and that kind of stuff. So I kind of wanted to write in that field. Most of my friends are string players, so that, you know, there's a good amount of you write for the people you have on hand so that you can have it performed. But in terms of how my singing practice actually informed my writing style on a whole, I think I brought an amount of the kind of lyricism in parts to my music from my singing practice, that I kind of brought a lyrical and melodic style to once I kind of found the compositional voice that I have at the moment. I find that maybe that's kind of been brought into it a little bit. Mm.
Do you have any thoughts on your aesthetic at the moment, like if you were to describe your music, or if you were to describe what makes your music unique to your own writing? Have you thought about how you'd verbalise what your music is like?
The easiest descriptor would be somewhere between post-minimal and neoclassical. I guess the neoclassical being the kind of lyrical aspect.
And so for someone who might be listening, who has no idea what you said, can you really break it down for us? Like, what does neoclassical and post-minimal mean to you?
So I guess, well, neoclassical, I guess the term, well, it was kind of a early last century kind of term that kind of started getting thrown around when composers who, instead of being the kind of modernist trends that were going on at the time, they started looking back to the classical kind of approach to form and harmony, but bringing it with with an extended kind of vocabulary. So for me, that's some amount the kind of lyrical nature and the lyrical approach to setting melody, to setting melodic ideas, not being afraid of having a melody with a harmony, but in a far more complex and interesting manner. In terms of harmonically, it's not heavily dissonant. It is fairly, it's approachable, and it's not straight up 1-4-5-1 or Mozart, but it's got a bit more complexity, but it is very approachable and familiar in many ways. Having an approach to form and proportion that's fairly well measured and not necessarily based on formal structures that were developed in the classical period, but kind of using that kind of sensibility towards proportioning out of work, combined with a very intuitive sense of doing so. For post-minimal music was the kind of music that was written by Steve Reich and Philip Glass and John Adams and all of them. Post-minimal, I guess, is when we move beyond having one chord for 20 minutes and start introducing other things. And obviously it's far more complex than that. So for me, I have a focus on the rhythmic aspects and the rhythmic qualities of the work, the use of slow building development of rhythmic and motivic ideas across a work, how we can use those to kind of structure work, but also give it a surprising, for something that's really well measured out, a surprisingly kind of organic unfolding, how you can use those features in a work. A phrase that I often end up using is that it's a kind of that my music ends up combining a lyrical melodicism with driving rhythmic aspects, that kind of thing. Fairly simplistic way of describing it.
Not at all. I think that that's a really nice way to break down what the buzzwords, as you say, and really look at what it is. And I think it's always different. Your own music is always different to yourself than it might be from what people hear when they listen
to it. Exactly, and that's I love hearing what other people actually think of my music. It's one way of how I conceive it, and it's another way of how people actually experience it, and that's great.
You're working on the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra Cybeck project at the moment. So what's your relationship with deadlines? Do you know when a piece is finished to you, or is it literally that you'll work on it until you'll keep fixing it until the clock strikes midnight?
Don't do this if you're writing assignments and if you're doing uni or school or anything like this, but I work really well last minute close up to a deadline, and it's really terrible. It's really bad for uni in that I end up writing most of my assignments the day they're due, but I seem to be good at it. So, but, and I guess it's similar in composition that I end up working I like working in the last couple of weeks before the earliest deadline. I like having set a deadline for when they need a first draft or when they need a draft that they can approach for a rehearsal. So even if I've got months, I will have set at that deadline. I will have started planning and getting ideas, but probably I will have set myself up a firm deadline, even if it's 3 months before the deadline that they actually need. And I'll try working very much to that. So that'll be a first draft, not necessarily first draft, but the first draft that I actually give the performers that's completely readable, playthroughable. I've tested it out myself, at least if it's a piano or a string instrument, I've tested it out. And then from there, I'm very happy to continue working on a work, especially with performers. A score and a sheet music is not, an artwork that needs to be framed, but they're a practical thing. They need to be notated in a way that the performer knows what they're going to mean. And it's not worth putting into the score if they can't actually play it. Obviously, there's going to be some things I won't compromise on, but then I'm always happy to work on changes with the performers. Eventually, there is a point when you have to let go. A number of drafts later, and it may have been performed once or twice by the time you get to that stage, but there is a point when I'll set down the score and that'll be that. Unless I actually, I found a spelling mistake in a score for a piece that I had written the end of last year, and it's been performed twice, and my friend who commissioned it just apparently noticed it after I gave him the first draft and just neglected to mention that one thing after we've gone through like 7 drafts until I realized like a couple of days later, so I did change that.
Well, that's good to know. To finish up, where do you see yourself in another 5 years?
In terms of where I am, I do really want to move overseas for a time to study overseas, but also to put myself into the culture of what's going on overseas. There's lots going on in Australia, but there's a lot more established. There's a lot of what's happening in Australia now is maybe a bit new and starting up, and we're starting to do things that have been happening, say, in New York for quite a while. So, for example, the kind of concert series that I've been running has been happening in New York and in America for quite a while. So I kind of want to be able to go over there and learn what I can and experience the way they're doing it so I can see what I do and don't want to bring to my practice and bring it back here. So I definitely want to do that for a few years. I either go to America for a while. I'd also love to go to London or England for a while. In terms of what I'm doing, I guess I want to be doing what I'm doing now, just more of it. I want to be able to keep writing pieces for commissions, keep doing a little bit of choral performing and classical vocal performing on the side, just because I enjoy it. Keep organizing concerts the way I'm organizing concerts at the moment, and kind of keep looking into how we can write pieces of music which are as suitable for the traditional ways of presenting music as they could be, also for kind of more contemporary, a bit more new and adventurous ways of presenting and performing music. Because I love both, and they're both necessary, but there doesn't need to be one or the other, and I want to keep experimenting with that.
Fantastic, Connor. I think that's a great place to end with. So thank you so much for joining me today on Making Conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Making Conversation podcast is brought to you by Making Waves. Making Waves is a free online listening resource bringing listeners the latest new music from Australian composers. We'd love for you to discover, listen, like, subscribe, and share new Australian music. You can find us at makingwavesnewmusic.com. We'd like to thank all the people who made this season possible. This includes the supporters of our crowdfunding campaign, project patron Cameron Lamb of Kamaklang, and Creative Partnerships Australia's match funding program. The series production team is Leah Blankendahl, Stephanie Eslake, Sasha Kelly, David John Lang, Matthew Lorenzen, Rebecca Aaron Smith, Chris Williams, Antonia Zappia, Daniel Thorpe, Thomas Green, Lisa Cheney, and Peggy Polias, along with interns Angus Baxter, Malena Radice, and Mark Wolfe. The podcast theme music was the work I/O by Australian composer Elia Simic Prozic. If you wish to learn more about the composer, music, or interviewer featured in this episode, head to our website and click podcast to view the show notes. If you're enjoying these podcasts from Making Waves, there are a number of ways in which you can show your support. You can subscribe to the podcast via iTunes or your favourite app. You might even like to leave a review. You can also share this episode and the series with your networks. Making Waves is a voluntary endeavour. If you're interested in volunteering or interning with us, we'd love to hear from you. We also encourage you to consider making a small one-off or continuing donation to support the ongoing promotion of new Australian music and composers. Visit makingwavesnewmusic.com/support.